KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, healthcare reform. Many say our healthcare system is broken, quickly pricing out the middle class.
Once you go and you try to look for a plan, and if you have something existing that might have to have surgery, get into an MRI machine that's $800, boy, you have to think twice whether you want to get some help.
And within about a year, I was diagnosed with a very long-term chronic illness. I have diabetes, and it's maintainable but exceptionally expensive to maintain.
What makes me nervous is a car accident. That's my biggest fear, is that I get in an accident and the ambulance or hospital bills, that really makes me nervous.
If it wasn't a matter of finances, I would still be on an HMO paying the $1,200, $1,300, because that would give me a peace of mind. And then, you know, health wouldn't be an issue.
Residents in the Contra Costa County city of Concord, we invited them to talk with us about their health care concerns, and their stories echoed what we're hearing across the nation, that Americans have very serious worries about their health care coverage, like whether they can afford it now and in the future as costs continue rising. We'll be hearing more from them later in the hour, but first, journalist Jonathan Cohn. In his new book, Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, Cohn examines what ails the U.S. healthcare system. There are now some 47 million Americans without health insurance, 6 million of them living right here in California. I asked Jonathan Cohn how it is the United States came to be the only Western industrialized country without universal government-run healthcare.
Well, you have to go back to the early 20th century, the 1920s. That's really the first period of time when medicine becomes sophisticated enough that it actually becomes expensive. And it quickly becomes so expensive that large numbers of people can no longer afford to get medical care. And so there is a debate in this country, really the first modern debate over how to organize a health insurance system. There is some discussion given to creating a universal health system where the government would guarantee everybody coverage. And actually, Franklin Roosevelt thought about adding it to the New Deal, but he worried that the opposition from special interest groups who opposed it would be so strong that it might actually undermine the entire Social Security Act. So he didn't. And instead, we got the system we have today where we relied on private health insurance. And the idea was that the working population would predominantly get coverage through their employers. And then people who didn't get insurance that way, well, we sort of spent the next 70 to 80 years figuring out how to help some of those people. And for a while, at least, we were partially successful at that.
Were the special interests who were allied against it back in the 30s and 40s the same ones who are against it now, against a government-run kind of universal care system?
Somewhat. The business community has traditionally been opposed to this largely on philosophical grounds. They oppose government interference in the private sector, and so they've opposed government getting involved in healthcare. Now, that has softened in recent years. The insurance industry has generally opposed universal healthcare, although they have softened too lately, as long, obviously, as if it's a plan that works for them. In other words, if it's a universal coverage plan that still involves them. I think the biggest change, though, the one that's most interesting, is physicians. You know, back in the 30s, they were really the most potent source of opposition to universal health care. They saw it as interference in their private practices. It was a threat to their incomes. And today, the physician community is pretty sharply divided over this. You still have some doctors who are adamantly opposed to universal health care, but you have quite a good deal of physician groups and many individual physicians who favor universal health care. And so the physician community has changed somewhat, but you still have some groups that are adamantly opposed to it. I think the most striking example of this is probably the small business community. The National Federation of Independent Business, in particular, is a strongly conservative group that, on strictly ideological grounds, if nothing else, will probably always oppose universal health care.
Here in California, we have another system that was invented in the 1940s, Kaiser Permanente, where the doctors run the system. It's a closed system. There isn't a middleman, an insurance company in the middle. What can be learned about Kaiser's experience here in California, which has now expanded to other states as well?
Sure. Well, you know, historically, Kaiser was an example of medical care in the United States at its best. You think of the old Kaiser program, you think of group, it's very similar to the old group practices that still exist also in the Seattle area, like group health at Puget Sound, or the multi-specialty groups like the Mayo Clinic, which is widely considered to provide some of the best health care on the entire planet. And the idea of this closed system where you have a group of doctors working together, it's really ideal. You have more information sharing. You have more actual clinical autonomy. The physicians tend to have more freedom than they do in a system where they have outside insurance companies second-guessing them. And you get excellent results. Now, Kaiser, one problem for Kaiser has been is that it has grown. It has had to compete in the marketplace with managed care companies run by traditional commercial insurers who, frankly, haven't been guided by the same ethos, who haven't always been willing to put quality before cost. And being forced to compete in that market, I think, has forced them to make some compromises. And that's why you do see some of the stories like you've seen today, like the scandal over the kidney transplants that made so much news. I mean, they are competing in a marketplace where doing the right thing is not rewarded. And that's really the problem with our healthcare system. Profits don't equal good healthcare. And increasingly, if you rely on the insurance industry to decide where to spend our healthcare dollar, people are going to suffer.
In your book, there's a chapter on Los Angeles, which features two people, Tony and Gloria Montenegro, who are immigrants from El Salvador. And in that chapter, you describe the situation in Los Angeles, saying that L.A. has come to resemble healthcare's version of apocalypse. Why did you write it that way, and what do you mean?
You know, back in the 1950s and 1960s, when our health insurance system was working well, or at least more well than it does today, you had a thriving middle class. People had jobs that provided insurance. Well, today, as Harold Meyerson, who has written for Los Angeles publications for years, likes to say, the bottom didn't fall out of the Los Angeles economy. The middle fell out. You lost all of those middle class jobs that provided insurance. And so now you have all these low-paying service jobs with people that don't provide insurance. And so you have millions of people who need access to health care who don't have it. And, of course, because they're low income, given the conditions many of them live in, they tend to develop worse health problems.
As you point out in the book, there have been several moments in our history. In 1912, with Teddy Roosevelt running for president on the Bull Moose Party, FDR, as you point out, Truman, Nixon talked about it a little bit, and then, of course, Clinton. There have been these moments, which we seem to have another one of now, where we're looking at our health care plan. Is there any reason to think that the outcome this time is going to be different than it was all those other times?
I think the outcome could be different. There are signs that the problem is worse, demonstrably. There are signs that people who once opposed universal health care are warming up to it. Again, I think about the coalition of business leaders that recently came out for universal health care, led by Steve Byrd at Safeway. You have Republican governors in California and Massachusetts who have either passed or are trying to pass universal health care. So all of these create conditions that are favorable to it. But the opposition of special interest groups remains strong. And frankly, the ambivalence of the American public remains an obstacle. I think most people like the idea of universal health care. But as we saw in 1994, when offered an opportunity to change, they become skittish. They think, well, I don't know if I trust the government to do this. And they look at their own situation and they think, I like my health insurance and I don't feel that insecure about it. I happen to think that's a mistake. I think the great error of 1994 was that the middle class thought they were invulnerable, that they were secure. And as I explain in the book, I think that turns out not to be true, that many middle class Americans now find themselves at risk of great financial or medical catastrophe because their insurance doesn't cover their bills or they simply don't have insurance. But until enough Americans realize that and come to realize this is their problem and not somebody else's problem, I think passing universal health care will be difficult.
Jonathan Cohn, he's author of the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So, what to do about a healthcare system that just isn't working for so many people? We wanted to hear what average citizens are thinking about their own healthcare situations, and so we invited a group of five people together in Concord, a city about 25 miles northeast of Oakland. You're going to hear some recordings from that session throughout the show, but first, let's hear these folks describe the choices they've made because of rising healthcare costs. Our panelists included Kristen Willis, a 32-year-old married mother of a 5-year-old daughter. She is self-employed. Harold Blair, a 54-year-old father of four who works full-time for the county social services department. Harold has diabetes and is insured through his job. Natalia Tosino, a 25-year-old woman with two part-time jobs who doesn't have health insurance. Kathy Renfro, a self-employed consultant and a married mother of seven who relies on Medi-Cal for her health care and that of her youngest children. And finally, Cesar Silva, a 56-year-old small business owner and married father of three.
My name is Cesar Silva, and I'm a small businessman. I do recall that in the first years, my choice, of course, was having an HMO. We were four in the family. Costs start coming up. So it used to be $300 a month, then $450, then $600, and hit the $1,000. So it was time for a change. I couldn't afford it anymore. Basically, the big choice right now is what sort of a deductible that you have. The rational thing to do was to try to protect yourself for those crisis situations. So all of a sudden, we ended up with a PPO with a $2,400 deductible. It created a feeling of instability many times, and the hopes that nothing happens. We are very concerned as to when do you really need to go to the doctor, because it's an added expense that you don't know how much is going to be.
My name is Natalia, and so I try to put off going to the doctor as much as I can as well, and years will go by and I don't go to the doctor, and this January I got really, really sick, and I went to see my doctor that I'd had my whole life through my mom's insurance. And I had bronchitis, fine, $95 for the visit, plus the medications, which I thought obviously was outrageous. Then about a week later, I had a severe ear infection, and I had to go back, another $95, and the treatment for the ear infection. Then like 3 days went by, and I woke up one morning, and both of my eyes were swollen shut. I had to go back to the doctor, I told him, you got to be kidding me. Like, I've been here three times this month. You can't possibly charge me $95. That's ridiculous. And he laughed, and he's like, how about $45? I was like, okay. But I had an eye infection, so I had to take care of that, and it was all from the same thing. But it was, I mean, I could have paid 2 months of health insurance with that, and it was something I didn't have at the time. And
if you have major insurance though, that you pay for and you have something that's very severe, though, and you're paying 20%, that 20% can add up quickly. That takes and wipes everything out.
Later on in our conversation in Concord, we heard about how having affordable health insurance led to better access for one of our guests. Kristen Willis, who is now 32 years old, was diagnosed with diabetes a decade ago. She told us how she applied for and was sold an individual insurance plan shortly before her diagnosis. Since then, she's had different jobs that offered her group insurance, but Kristen never gave up her expensive individual plan because she thought it would be almost impossible to get another insurance company to cover her if she needed individual insurance later on. Now she has two plans, including one she doesn't really need, because her husband's new employer is providing Kristen's family with a group plan that covers premiums and copays. That saves them $1,200 a year in out-of-pocket expenses.
What difference do you think that makes to you in terms of the decisions you make?
It absolutely makes a huge difference. We've been on that for a month. Today actually marks the end of the first 30 days since they've made that change, and it's huge. I went to the doctor yesterday, in fact, and I can assure you that prior to knowing that I was going to be reimbursed for my copay and my pharmacy fees, I would have held out. And when I called the advice nurse, they thought I might have pneumonia, so you better believe they wanted me to come in, but I don't think I even would have called and made that phone call in the first place to talk to them about it if I hadn't known that it was taken care of. So it makes a huge difference to have that peace of mind and not feel like you're taking such a risk, because your health is incredibly important. And sometimes if you delay, your situation will worsen and you just, you know, are making a decision that you think is the best and it may not be.
And joining us now, two people very familiar with all these issues. They've been deeply involved in our national conversation about health care for years, and I think they have the battle scars to prove it. They are Mark Smith, president of the California Healthcare Foundation, and Larry Levitt, vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let me ask you first, Larry, costs. That seems to be underneath so many of these issues, whether it's for small businesses, individuals, even governments struggling to pay the cost of health care for their employees and their retirees. Do you see that as the fundamental issue here, cost, and why is it so?
Yeah, I would say cost is the issue, and Cesar, who we heard from earlier, said it exactly right. I mean, he talked about his insurance premiums rising from a few hundred dollars a month up to $1,000 a month, and that's very typical. Premiums are now average about $12,000 a year for a family. That's like buying a new car, a compact car, but a new car each year, and most families can't possibly afford that. Most businesses can't possibly afford that, and they've almost doubled in the last 6 years. So premiums are high and getting higher each year and out of reach for most families.
And they're going up much faster than the rate of inflation.
Absolutely. Double, triple the rate of inflation, the increase in workers' wages, profits for employers.
And so why is that? Why are costs going up so quickly?
Well, fundamentally, what drives the increase in healthcare costs is technology, medical technology. So that's things like new drugs that are more expensive than the old drugs, new x-ray machines or scanners that are more expensive than the old machines. And sometimes that new technology is better. For example, our cardiac care has improved dramatically. Deaths from heart disease have plummeted, but that comes at a cost.
And so you're saying that you said sometimes those new gadgets are better, sometimes they're not. Are we paying for more than we really need to have?
Well, we're certainly, I mean, if you compare us to other countries, we're paying far more than other countries are. And in large part because they all have systems in place to assess these new technologies, to assess these new drugs, decide whether they're better than the old gadgets, and decide how much it's appropriate to pay for them. You know, we in this country have no system like that.
Mark Smith, first of all, do you agree that cost is the fundamental issue, and what can anybody really do about that?
Well, I certainly agree. The only thing that's worse than today's cost is people's fears about tomorrow's cost, because our experience has been that costs seem to go up no matter what we do. And as Larry said, and as your guest said, people are being increasingly priced out of the system. The healthcare system in our country, for all its good intent, is pricing people out of the ability to access it. I guess I'd look at it this way. Sometimes the problem is the new technology, but sometimes the way our system works, we don't replace old technology with new technology. We simply add the new technology on, and now we're paying for both costs. It's a little bit like if you went to a bank and you had to use a teller to use your ATM machine. Well, that's how we do things in healthcare. We add the new scanner to the old scanner. We have people who are often overtrained for what we can now do with new technology, but because their income needs to be supported, because we're concerned about safety, we have people doing things that could cost less, but they cost more because we have highly trained people doing them.
Can you think of an example?
Sure. When I was in training as a physician, to diagnose a strep throat meant that you had to have a human who'd been to school for a long time. We call him a pediatrician. And the way he did that was he'd examine you, he'd take your history, he'd look in your throat, he'd feel your nodes, take your temperature, integrate all this information, and make an educated guess about whether you had strep throat or not. And to do that, you had to pay someone who'd been to school a long time. Today, that same diagnosis can be made with a little stick by a high school graduate for about $5. And yet, our system largely still pays pediatricians' wages to do something which often we frankly don't need a pediatrician to do.
But aren't nurse practitioners and physician's assistants doing more of that kind of work?
They are, but the way our market works, because we have so many rules about who has to have how many licenses and how many years. Actually, in California, nurse practitioners don't make an awful lot less than most primary care physicians. And my point is that a lot of the things that we can do with technology don't need nurse practitioners. They can be done by medical technicians. They often can be done by patients themselves. So I'm not suggesting this is the only reason for cost, but I am saying there are clearly places where technology could make things cost less, as they do in most every other industry, and instead the way we've deployed it or paid for it makes them cost more.
Larry Leavitt, who are the big losers and who are the big winners in the system the way it is now?
Well, we talk about cost, and you and I can talk about cost containment as making health insurance, healthcare more affordable to us. Unfortunately, every time we try and make it more affordable to us, that's money out of the pockets of some often quite powerful interest, whether that's a drug company, a medical technology company, even doctors. And most people do trust their doctors, but they are a cost in the system.
Do you then agree with what Jonathan Cohn said earlier, that profits don't equal good health care, that profits in some way get in the way of good, affordable health care?
Well, the current system makes it very hard to get costs out of the system, because we have developed a system that is so driven by profit, that's so driven by Wall Street in many ways, that it's very hard to move. And if you look at other countries, and every other country, every other industrialized country has some form of universal coverage and a mechanism for controlling costs, they created those systems many, many years ago. I think if those countries tried to move from our system to what they have now, they would find the same difficulties we're having.
Mark Smith.
I think the irony is that more than 20 years of research led by a guy named Jack Wenberg at Dartmouth Medical School has proved that more care and more expensive care does not necessarily equal better care. In fact, often it's inferior care. So I guess I object a little bit to the notion that profit is driving it, because a lot of not-for-profit hospitals and doctors who are not big companies are the recipients of that payment. And we know that you're going to pay a lot more in Miami than you will in Minnesota, and you'll probably get worse care.
Why is it that we want all this care? Isn't it partly because we see commercials on television suggesting that we ask our doctors about this or that drug, and the internet, which is also often kind of steers us in one direction or another?
It certainly is the case, and with the rise of direct-to-consumer advertisement, you now have consumers, patients who are going into their doctor's office asking for particular drugs, even particular hip joints. But the fact of the matter is, most people get their care at the recommendation of their physicians. Most people don't run around willy-nilly saying, I need an MRI, I want a hip replacement. Physicians, though they are not the people who make most of the money in this system, are still the people who direct the activities of the system. And for the most part, people are not getting this care at their own direction. They're getting it at the direction of their doctors.
Who does make most of the money?
Well, hospitals make a lot of money. Drug companies make a lot of money. Medical device companies make a lot of money. But here's the other thing. Insurance companies make a lot of money. Everybody in healthcare, doctors, nurses, foundation executives, researchers, makes more money in the United States than they do in other countries. And so part of what we have to recognize is that one of the ways in which other countries have been able to restrain spending is that everybody in the system makes less money compared to the average citizen.
Well, our panel of citizens in Concord had a lot to say about the cost of health care. Here's another part of our conversation where we asked them what they'd like legislators and the governor to keep in mind as they consider changes to California's health care system.
It always comes down to the money, whether someone's making a lot or doesn't have enough. Somebody somewhere could probably take a little bit of a cut, and that would make it affordable. So if it's a pharmaceutical company, I know for sure they're making a lot of money for me every year. I can guarantee you that. Not that I don't appreciate it. It is keeping me alive, and it is keeping me relatively healthy, so I am thankful for that. But it is really expensive. They would need to examine all of the facets that they're looking at, not just the cost and not just the access, but the total healthcare picture that includes maybe some holistic approaches to healthcare, as well as pharmaceuticals and hospital visits, et cetera.
Harold, Cesar, Talia.
I agree with Kathy and Christian that the whole system needs to be looked at before a whole program is set in motion, that we get to see a general picture of who's getting served, whether everyone really gets served, what the quality of the service is going to be for everyone, and what is going to be required of us, you know, as a whole, everyone, what we're going to be required to do and what sacrifices we all need to make, because we know there's got to be a sacrifice in there in order to get a whole general health plan for everyone. If we want to try to include everyone, we need to know what everybody is responsible for and what you're responsible in your life for your family and yourself and what sacrifice you're willing to do.
I think it's a matter of priorities, and I think it's like other issues. Like the immigration issue. You have so many interests on it that at the end, nothing gets done because you want to please all these different groups. And you need to reconsider everything. And the result is going to be a different animal, you know, that is not going to be liked by the most.
Right.
You know,
right.
We're going to probably affect everything.
Larry Levitt, I was struck by what Harold Blair said in that little passage there, that there's got to be a sacrifice, that everyone's going to have to give something up, including us citizens, if we're going to have access for everyone. Do you agree with that?
I do, and I think that's part of the, frankly, what the governor has done right. I mean, the governor has proposed his plan and sold it as an idea of shared responsibility.
And just, if you would, just summarize what his plan is.
Sure. So the governor, I mean, the key part of the governor's plan is that everyone would be required to have insurance. Either you get it through your employer, you get it through the state, through Medi-Cal, or you buy it yourself. And what comes along with that is the government then has a responsibility to make that insurance affordable to you, to bring down the cost and to provide you a subsidy based on your income, and that everyone pays into the system fairly. Individuals are paying in, employers are paying in, providers, doctors, and hospitals are paying in through fees, and the federal and state governments are kicking in money as well.
That assumes that someone isn't paying their fair share now. Who would that be?
Well, one can fair share is certainly in the eyes of the beholder, but the people who aren't paying in now, there are businesses who don't provide coverage, mostly small businesses who don't provide insurance to their workers and therefore aren't paying into the system.
And some big businesses.
And some big businesses as well, particularly employers of lower wage workers. There are also individuals who could afford to buy insurance who are not now.
Mark, your thoughts on sacrifice and what do we have to give up as Californians if we're going to get some kind of coverage for everybody, including the 6 or so million Californians who don't have it now?
Well, I think, first of all, we may have to give up some of our notions of what high-quality care is, because I don't think we can afford the current system with the current system's increases for everybody. One of your interviews earlier mentioned Kaiser Permanente, and I guess Jonathan Cohen was saying Kaiser did the right thing in terms of putting quality before cost. It's important to remember the reason Kaiser Permanente got to where it is today is because Kaiser Permanente used to be a lot cheaper than what was then thought of as standard, quote, high-quality, unquote, care.
Cheaper in terms of the premiums?
Cheaper in terms of the premiums, absolutely. In the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s when Kaiser was growing, you were talking about something like 60% or sometimes less of what you'd pay elsewhere. And now Kaiser is about the same and in some instances more. Perhaps some people are willing to pay for that, but the fact is that if we look at this notion of fair share, I want to go back to the point about Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon didn't do a little. Richard Nixon called a joint session of the U.S. Congress and proposed universal health care paid for by an employer mandate. When he made that proposal, the cost of a family policy was about 8% of the minimum wage. Now it's closer to 108% of the minimum wage. So if you're thinking about some of these small businesses or even large businesses who pay workers relatively low wages because that's where they are in the labor market, the notion that they could or would double the wages in order to pay for health care doesn't seem very likely.
So does that mean, as Jonathan Cohen suggests, that our whole system of employer-based care really is just melting away?
Well, melting slowly. Like Mark Twain said, predictions of its death have been exaggerated before. There's no question that if you were designing a system today based on today's medical care and its expenses, you'd have to be nuts to say, let's start with employers. The problem is that everybody, employers, workers, unionized workers, people who want to unionize workers, see this as the system that we have, and we haven't yet figured out how to make a transition from this system to a new one.
Do you agree with that, Larry? I know you were involved with the Clinton plan in the mid-90s, which really was not a fundamental overhaul, I don't think. It was, although it was portrayed that way.
Yeah, we considered it quite modest, but it was not portrayed as modest.
Those are some of the scars I was referring
yes.
to.
And I think Mark made a really important point that you have to think about, no one would design this employer-based system from scratch, but you also don't want to trash something that works for millions of people in California and across the country until you have some alternative.
But it's not really working that well for employers anymore, is it?
Everyone is concerned, but it's not, it still is the main way people get insurance. And while fewer employers are providing coverage, still the majority of employers are still doing it. So it's not crashing and burning. It's sort of slowly declining.
Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Also with us, Mark Smith, president of the California Healthcare Foundation. We have lots more to talk about, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
As many as 50 million Americans suffer from allergies, while 20 million more have asthma. The potential triggers are everywhere, from pollen to peanuts, and the impact can sometimes be deadly. Why have allergy and asthma rates, especially in children, risen so dramatically in recent years? Join us as we look at allergies and asthma on the June edition of Health Dialogues.
And we continue our conversation about healthcare reform in California. I'm Scott Schaefer. You're listening to Health Dialogues. Our guests this hour, Larry Levitt, Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and Mark Smith, President of the California Healthcare Foundation. Gentlemen, one issue that complicates things in California that isn't so much of an issue in a place like, say, Maine or Massachusetts, at least to the extent that it is here, is immigration, undocumented immigration. Mark Smith, how does that complicate things here?
Well, you know, I think it complicates it more politically than any other way. In these debates, one of the flashpoints always is, what are you going to do about covering people who are here in an undocumented fashion? And sometimes one hears allegations that our emergency rooms are crowded with the undocumented, with uninsured people. As a general statement, that's actually not true. Undocumented people don't represent a significant portion of spending, nor, I think, does anyone who studies this for a living think that it's a major problem economically, but it certainly is one of the big problems politically. It also complicates things in one other way. If we had a system in which everyone was truly covered, and everyone's not going to be covered unless you make people be covered, then some of the stopgap measures that we've put together, clinics for uninsured people, hospital payments to cover uncompensated care, could presumably go away because they cover people who aren't covered. But if you've got a residual population who is undocumented, who would not be covered by your reform plan, then you can't make those other funding streams go away because we're still hopefully a civilized country enough to want to care for them in some way.
So you'd be paying twice, in a sense.
That's probably part of the problem.
Larry, do you agree with that?
I do, and I would just emphasize that the undocumented immigrants in California are not the bulk of the uninsured. Most of the uninsured are legal residents of the state, and most of the uninsured are working, people who we would consider playing by the rules and deserve to get insurance. That doesn't mean it's not a big problem politically, even though it's a small bit of the problem economically.
Well, we asked our folks in Concord what their thoughts were on immigration and undocumented immigrants, whether or not they should be entitled to universal care. Let's hear what they had to say.
My partner is undocumented and is only undocumented because when trying to get a visa to come here to Mexico, he was denied. And he left his family and left his home. He comes from a place that there literally are no jobs, and his whole family is counting on him to support them. And I think him having to walk here 10 days and seeing people deal with that and people coming with their kids and pregnant women and people dead and people dying, that's a huge sacrifice, and I think people don't take that into account. And once they're here and all they're doing is working 24 hours a day to help their families, and if something – and they do get sick, they do go to the hospital, that could be a year's worth of salary – that I spent on one day in the hospital, 2 days, an ambulance. So I definitely think they should have health care.
Cesar, what about you?
Well, that brings another complexity to the issue. And definitely we're not going to solve it because I identify with that experience. Within a perfect legal system, everybody participates, then it ought to benefit from it. And if somebody is not within that system, then you question it. And I have a lot of stories that addresses to those issues. One is an experience of going to Martinez for the delivery of a child. And here is a person that is not legal in the country, obtained the services at no cost. And here's somebody without insurance who is a legal person in here, files taxes every year, got a $30,000 bill. And you better pay it. If not, you're going to get liens and so forth. So if you fall into that experience, your position is going to be different.
Mark Smith, you hear a lot of stories like that one from Cesar, where in some ways people who are, quote-unquote, playing by the rules but don't have insurance, maybe because their employer doesn't have it, doesn't offer it, getting the short end of the stick versus people who are very, very poor, undocumented perhaps, but who can go to an emergency room and get care. Mm-hmm. To what extent is that
really a big issue? I mean, it's obviously a hot-button issue, but to what extent is it really an important issue in terms of the overall health care policy in California?
Well, I think it's an important issue in this way. We have a program which pays for insurance for low-income people. It's called Medi-Cal. It's California's Medicaid program. We have another one called Healthy Families, which can insure children whose families make more money than you can make and be eligible for Medi-Cal. But the roots of the Medi-Cal program really are still tied in many ways to the old welfare program from which it sprang. And so we have a system in which it kind of gets to be all or nothing. If you're really, really poor, and particularly if you have children, you and or your children will be covered by Medi-Cal, in which typically you don't pay anything. Now, the network you get to go to isn't very good, but if you make just $3 more than the limit, then you get nothing. That's true for people, low-income people, working people, whether they're documented or undocumented. In many ways, I think that's a much bigger problem. We've got a system here that's kind of like the welfare system in that you fall off a cliff when you make $1 too much.
Well, as we heard earlier in the program, Massachusetts is implementing a new statewide plan to cover most of its residents with health insurance. The plan requires every resident to have insurance, and it gives them until July 1st of this year to purchase insurance. And if they can't afford it, the state is going to help them do it. Now, the Massachusetts plan was widely hailed, as you may recall, when it was signed into law a year ago. It was the result of a compromise between Republican Governor Mitt Romney, who's now running for president, and Democratic leaders in the Massachusetts state legislature. And I spoke with reporter Martha Biebinger of public radio station WBUR in Boston about the new health care plan there. The law requires that everybody have insurance, whether they pay for it themselves or get it through a subsidized kind of a plan that the state helps to pay for. How are people reacting to this mandate that they have insurance?
You know, it's really hard, Scott, at this stage to gauge that in any substantive way. A lot of people have already been enrolled or signed up for health insurance, about 122,000. Massachusetts residents who were uninsured a year ago now have health insurance through this law. But that leaves us with 250, maybe 300,000 people who have not yet signed up. And it's a big question whether they will see some value in these plans and be able to afford them, or whether they will see this as a requirement that they really rebel against. Will we see a series of lawsuits? Will we see a blizzard of phone calls to state representatives and senators that force them to back off of their support for this law? It's really unknown at this stage how much resistance we might see.
And what happens if people just say, you know what, screw it, I'm not going to sign up?
Well, practically speaking, what happens is that in the next tax year, so you're filing for taxes for 2007, you'll have to say whether you have health insurance or not. And if you either check no or the state finds out that you lied, you would lose your personal exemption, which is about $219 in Massachusetts. In the second year, the second full year that the law is in effect, you would have to pay a penalty for not having insurance, which would be half the cost of the lowest plan on the market. And that could be well over $1,000. And then the other thing is, if the state doesn't find a way to control healthcare spending, then not only will the plans become unaffordable for many people who will be required to buy them, but the law will also become unaffordable for the state, which is spending $500 million next year on the health insurance subsidies.
California is now going through a similar process here in the legislature and with the governor. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you saw there in Massachusetts that you think might be useful for people here in California to know in terms of pitfalls or that sort of thing?
Well, I know that a big part of the debate there is whether or not health insurance should be mandatory. And I have to say, based on the experience in Maine, where it has not been mandatory to date, the enrollment, the participation, is much, much slower than if there is a requirement and, as you see in Massachusetts, a penalty that really pushes people towards that requirement. Some place in that balance of pushing people towards doing something that they are not doing now voluntarily is needed in order for this type of provision to work.
Martha Biebinger is a reporter with WBUR Public Radio in Boston. Martha, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Larry Levitt, what do you think of the approach Massachusetts is taking? Of course, it's still very soon. We don't know how it's going to work out, but is that a good model for California?
Well, and it's very similar to the model that the governor has proposed, and people in Sacramento are watching it, not surprisingly, very, very carefully. And I think we're fortunate that we get to watch Massachusetts unfold as we debate the issue in California. And there are a number of things that we need to keep our eye on. One is the reaction to this individual mandate, the idea that the government is going to go to people and say, you have to buy insurance, and this will make the overall system better for everyone. Will people rebel against that, or will they see it as a reasonable approach? And second is, are the plans going to be affordable? And Massachusetts has had a big fight over the last several months trying to get the cost of plans down so that they're reasonably priced for people who are going to be required to buy them.
Mark Smith, if people are going to be required in Massachusetts and perhaps one day in California to buy health insurance, what's to stop businesses, employers, from basically saying, well, we're not going to provide it anymore then. You can just buy it in the marketplace.
Well, in Massachusetts and in most of the proposals in California, there's also an employer mandate, at least as the proposals have unwound. So there'd be a requirement for businesses to offer and in some instances to subsidize and for individuals to buy. But I think Larry's quite right. First, there are a lot of differences between California and Massachusetts in terms of number of uninsured, in terms of how much money they make. But the most important thing, I think, is to remember there's no such thing as universal voluntary anything, not taxes, not military service, not union dues. If you really want everybody to have it, you've got to make them have it. And as we started this conversation about the problem of costs, people are already raising in California, as they're now raising in Massachusetts, how can you say you've got to buy a policy that's going to cost $2,000 a year, and which for many people, since that policy is likely to have a high copay and deductible, may not get them anything except peace of mind.
And I think the jury's really out about how people will perceive this. I mean, will they perceive this as Governor Romney in Massachusetts, Governor Schwarzenegger here in California have sold it as shared responsibility or as shared pain? Because it hits a lot of people. It's the requirement to buy coverage. Insurance companies under both the Massachusetts and Governor Schwarzenegger's proposal have to sell regardless of your health status. Employers have to ante up. Doctors and hospitals have to ante up. And, will people come together or will it splinter the...
And there are other plans being floated in California, one notably by Senator Sheila Kuehl, which is a single-payer kind of plan, which would essentially eliminate insurance companies. And people would pay into employers and individuals would pay into a plan or into a system that would provide access to care for everyone. Mark Smith, your thoughts about that approach?
Well, I suppose if you were starting from scratch, I think that's probably much closer to what most of us think would be a rational way to do this. I think there are a couple of problems. First of all, most of these single-payer proposals assume that you can simply get your arms around all of the money in the system. I'm not sure how you just take Medicare. I'm not sure how you deal with military dependents, how you deal with federal employees, how you deal with millions of people who have commitments in union contracts and in other ways of private health insurance, Medigap policies, and the rest. So as a practical matter, it's not clear to me how quickly such a thing could actually be done.
Does that mean you could only do that sort of thing well at the national level?
Well, I think most of us think that if you were going to do it, there are so many levers to health policy that exist at the national level. I think most of us think while you can certainly achieve significant expansions at the state level, that's something that's truly universal and that re-engineers some of these system issues, which, again, let's be clear, it's not like all this money is paying for high, consistent quality. For you to work on those issues, there are some things that could be done at the state level, but I'd be interested in whether Larry agrees that in the end, this is really a national problem.
Larry?
And I think the truth is it's not just a single-payer system. I mean, it's any of these systems that are very hard to do on the state level. They actually depend, both Massachusetts and California, depend on a lot of federal money coming into the state to make this work. And I think that, you know, the value of the debate here is to provide momentum. If California can enact a plan like the governor's or like the plans in the legislature, it would definitely show the way for the rest of the country and I think drive the presidential debate and then a health reform debate after the presidential campaign.
Larry, you were involved, as I mentioned earlier, in the Clinton plan, among others, but the one that Hillary Clinton famously tried to shepherd through Congress. What did you learn from that experience that can be applied today here in California?
Several things, a lot of things, actually. One is that this is very hard to do. There are a lot of interests involved in healthcare. It's a sixth of the economy. You can't do anything without affecting a lot of people with a lot of power, and that makes it extremely difficult politically. Also learn that people are, while people worry about the future, they are also in many ways very attached to their current healthcare arrangements. And the more you monkey with those arrangements, the more the political peril to you. And finally, I learned that this has to happen on a bipartisan basis with a lot of interest groups involved. This is too big to jam down anyone's throat. And I think the governor's approach in that sense has been really positive in wanting to work with Democrats.
Mark Smith, you also worked on the Clinton plan. What do you agree with what Larry learned, or do you have some other lessons?
I agree entirely, and I have one other lesson. I think Larry would agree, I certainly think, that the failure of that plan actually set things back in Washington for quite some time, because you can only get it up to have these big fights, but so often. And I think that's important because I think it means as we enter this debate in California and in the country, we have to be very thoughtful about what we're doing. We've got to pay attention to these tough issues on the front end as opposed to assuming that they'll all work themselves out, because if you try and fail, you don't necessarily deserve a pat on the back for giving it the old college try. You can actually set things back if you try and fail. So that was the lesson that I learned.
And how would we avoid that this time here in California?
Well, I think for our foundation, part of what we're trying to do is to help people keep their eye on some inconvenient truths. There is an awful lot of myth-making in healthcare. We talked a little bit about the undocumented before. That certainly gets more heat than light, and there are a number of others. And so part of the role that we try to play is to help everybody use the same set of facts and try to think thoughtfully about how you actually solve these problems, particularly those of cost, but others as well, as opposed to assuming that if you just pass a law or make a proposal, they'll all go away. The history of these efforts in a number of states is that even if you can get a fragile alliance for the moment around a set of vague promises and not much accounting for money, once the increases come in, once people actually see the bill, these things tend to fall apart.
But there's also a bill that is maybe harder to identify, harder to see, which is the cost of providing care for the uninsured, right? I mean, that's not quite as tangible. And therefore, maybe, you know what I'm saying? You're looking at me like...
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the uninsured impose a cost on us and on the system in many ways. I mean, the governor's talked about the hidden tax, that the idea that we're paying for care when people do go to the emergency room, and that shows up in higher insurance premiums. But I would say more importantly, the uninsured themselves are paying a cost in terms of their health. I mean, people who are uninsured die sooner. They end up in the hospital for conditions that could be treated by a primary care physician, and they just don't have the resources to get to that primary care physician.
And so, that's why all of us fight so hard to solve this problem. But I'll give you an example here. If you think that we're going to finance this expansion by all the money we're going to save from the emergency room care that the uninsured will no longer require, that's absolutely not true. The uninsured use the emergency room less than people with insurance do. So that's not a reason not to expand coverage, but it is a reason not to count on some windfall, because if you go into the plan thinking that you're going to get a lot of money from there, you'll be sorely disappointed.
This is going to be expensive no matter how you look at it. Right?
Well, and the financing of these plans is key. I mean, it's not just got to be financed this year, next year, but it's got to be financed 10 years from now. And, you know, once you get serious about where that money's going to come from, you'll find yourself with even a larger number of enemies.
If we get to the point where if there's just consensus, okay, we can't get this done, is there something else we could do? For example, let's cover all children, or is that not really going to fix the problem either? Is that not really enough of a slice of that pie of uninsured?
There's no, that certainly won't fix the problem. I mean, it won't get everyone covered. It won't deal with the cost issues. But that's not to say there aren't people out there who are deserving of access to care and that we can't do something to help them, whether that's kids. And frankly, Mark talked about this earlier, but uninsured single adults are actually the group most likely to be uninsured because they're not eligible for any current program. So it doesn't matter how poor you are. If you're a childless adult, you have almost nowhere to turn.
Mark?
I think there's something else. It depends on how we define the problem. We've been talking a lot today about the problem of the uninsured, and that's certainly a big problem. But there are also other problems of quality, other problems of cost that interact with the uninsured because it's part of what makes our system so expensive. And so many of the discussions about expanding coverage, frankly, are expanding coverage to a system whose fundamental underpinnings need to be examined. So I think there's a lot that we can do that may not get us universal coverage, but that can help get more people coverage and that can also work on some of these other underlying problems of the system.
When you look out into the future, some of the things that are really expensive are caring for things like diabetes, which is an epidemic, and as is childhood obesity. We haven't talked about personal responsibility here. How big a difference can that make if we, you know, can cut in half the number of kids who are overweight, Larry?
Long term, it's enormous. You know, we've got rising numbers of obesity, which affect all kinds of conditions, whether it's diabetes, whether it's heart disease, whether it's asthma. And long term, that is certainly a way to bring down costs and frankly, more importantly, keep people healthy. In the next 5 to 10 years, that's not likely to make an enormous difference.
But here's one of the areas where we need to reform our system, no matter how much expansion we're able to improve. We've got a system that pays for the surgery when you get the lung cancer, but doesn't pay to counsel you to stop smoking. We've got a system that will pay for the amputation or the eye surgery that are the consequence of your diabetes, but doesn't have any payment mechanism to get you to eat right and exercise more. So that's part of how our system is imbalanced, and it's part of the reform that we need to get to in addition to expanding coverage.
And that comes back to what, values and priorities to a certain extent?
Values, priorities, also to how our system is financed, how it's organized, and what we consider important to do.
Okay. Mark Smith, president of the California Healthcare Foundation, thank you very much for being with us. Also, thanks to Larry Levitt, vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Lots to talk about, and there will be in the coming weeks as well. If you missed any part of our discussion or want to listen to past programs, you can go to our website. It's californiareport.org. You just click on Health Dialogues. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Our engineers are Danny Bringer and Seal Muller. We had production assistance this month from Howard Gelman and WBUR's Glenn Alexander. Special thanks to Molly Clark from Monument Futures in Concord. Eric Gillespie is the outreach manager. Our web content editor is Alex Porcaro. Erica Kelly is the researcher. The senior producer of Health Dialogues is David Minko. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment for coverage of healthcare in California and the members of KQED Public Radio.